Position number 16808, reel 9.
Reg Spittle's reel 9.
So we, as I say, we changed over, and we now had these centaurs, two centaurs and a honey, that was a General Stuart American tank, to a troop. Well, it was rather ridiculous and comical in a way, although from training point of view it was a bit of a serious subject, because what happened was the centaur, with an imbalance of the engine not being powerful for the weight of the vehicle, could not do the same performance as the Crusaders had done previously, and a commander automatically gets into an attitude of knowing his vehicle, knowing its qualities and capabilities and what he can do with it. So initially it was comical, because the troop officer and the troop sergeant had the two centaurs, and I, being a troop corporal, had the honey. Well, there's no comparison in any of these vehicles to each other. Well, the sergeant and the officer immediately found out that when we were going along these wolds in these deep valleys, and you get a hill to climb, I realised that whereas they'd been able to climb certain inclines with a Crusader, they could not now do it with a Centaur. They had to pick a lesser obstacle to climb over that they used to be able to climb over the Crusader, but they couldn't climb over now with the Centaur. And the troop corporal, who was me in a honey, was worse off than either of them, because I got rubber tracks, these rubber block tracks on, you see, and there was no comparison between them and the metal battle tracks on an ordinary tank. So when it came to a slope, as you probably know, if you're wearing leather shoes and you walk across a field, when you come off onto an ordinary pavement, your feet are slippy because of the moisture that the leather has taken from the grass as you walked across. And initially, if you don't scuff your shoes, you find they'll tend to slip initially. Well, I had that experience with the honeys because of the rubber tracks. And I used to look at a slope and think, well, yeah, I might be able to get up there. And we'd start to climb this slope, and we'd get to a point where the tracks were going round and the tank was standing still. So we'd have to let it roll back into the dip and go further along till the slope wasn't so severe, and eventually arrive at a gradient that we could climb, you see. Well, this didn't go down very well with the two centaurs, who could climb a gradient much greater than I could, much sooner than I could. So we frequently had the situation where Mr. Robson would come up and say, "Hello, Baker, where the bloody hell are you?" And I used to say, "Baker replying, I'm in the next valley, shan't be long, sir." And I would have to go all the way around to get round to the valley where they were, by which time they were ready to carry on with the next part of the exercise and leave me again, and then we'd repeat the performance. And it used to be comical. Mr. Robson doing his nut, because I was never where he wanted me at any one time. And me being, I'm rather a calm sort of a nature, I could see the funny side of it, and all the lads were enjoying it. So it was never serious, you know. We couldn't do any serious training in this situation, you see. But it was comical. The only trouble was, we went up to Filingdale, and during the war, that was a big tank range, firing ranges up there during the war, Filingdale. And all that was up there was one Nissen hut, some stoves to boil water on, to boil your guns out, and a couple of ballast stoves in there to try and keep warm, and sheep. That was all that was up there. And the little low wall was about 2.5 feet tall. And it wasn't an organised permanent firing range, it was more a thing that they'd done just to create one for the troops up there to use, you see, because we couldn't use the ones in the south of England that we always used to use at Bulford and down to Wales at Linney Head, because the Americans had got all those, you see. The southern part of England was more or less American, and the Midlands and the north was all English or anybody else, you see. So this stuff up there, a lot of it was sort of botched up, like, you know, temporary, you see. Anyway, we used to go up to Farley Bay. We went up there, and it was in the winter, and we'd had all this snow, and we'd still got this situation of two centaurs and one honey. Well, of course, in the snow, it was totally useless. Once it got off the road in the area with these rubber tracks, it was useless. Well, I don't know if they got them in the museum, but they used to have, if you see our wartime photos, round the turret of a honey, you look and you wonder what they might be. They look like metal bars, which is what they actually are, and they go all the way around the turret, bolted onto the side of the turret. People might think, they can't see any use for them, probably there to give a little bit of extra armour. But what they are, they're called grousers, and they fit the track. And what you have to do is unbolt them off the doings, and what you do, we've never done it till we got up there, we never knew how many, but we had to count how many of the grouses they were bolted all round the turret, and then count how many plates there were in the track. So you imagine what the lads were saying about, oh, bloody goodness, I mean, 1, 2, 3, 4, 4, how far we got? Put your hand on here so I don't lose count. And then we was counting the number of plates on the track all the way around, and then having to divide the number of grouses strapped to the turret of where to screw it on. You see, so you perhaps go every fifth plate, you put one of these grouses on, you, metal grouses, you see. So in effect, you put on metal bars across the rubber plates to give you a grip in the snow and the countryside, you see. And we had all that to do. Of course, it took us ages, you know. And we went out there doing this fun. It was comical, you know, because you couldn't, the circumstances and the snow and that, you know, and you just couldn't cope with it. It was really a waste of time. But anyway, we did all this and this sort of thing, and we eventually finished up with Cromwell's proper, and we got to a point where they didn't know what to do with us. They were so trained, as you might say, and they didn't send us out on exercise. I mean, previously we'd done several large exercises that lasted 6 weeks. You know, and you go off and you live off the land, basically. And we used to have these people come round, umpires they called them, and they told us we were privileged to go into people's garden and take their potatoes and greens and things like that, you see, what we wouldn't be expected to do in a foreign country, which was a bit stupid, really, because the first thing they told us when we went to Normandy was no looting, you see. And that meant going in somebody's garden and pinching his produce. And yet, on the big exercises, the final exercise up Yorkshire, they were doing this to get us to be able to live rough, as you might say, and not rely on organised cooking facilities and backs and support. You know, that they realised that this support, the backup support, the situation might not allow for it always to be efficient, you see. And there'd be times when we'd be expected to cope for ourselves. Anyway, we did these big exercises, but we reached a point where they dare not anymore do any more exercises or anything, and they didn't know what to do with us. But they've got to keep you occupied, otherwise you sort of get out of hand. And I did a mortar course. They said they got a list of courses we could choose to do, of short, like sort of 3 or 4 weeks. And I chose to do a mortar course. I went and did a 3-inch mortar course with the coilers, that's the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, and it was really enlightening, you know, these mortars. The devastation a mortar can cause, you don't realise until you've had anything to do with them. And at different distances, ranges, say 100 yards, 200 yards, 300 yards, 400 yards, depending on the distance they went, depended on how many bombs, as they called them, you could get up in the air at one time. And I always remember it, because we were working in sort of rough ground, surrounded by houses and that, and the kids used to come and watch us, and used to help us dig them out the ground again, because they used to have to dig these dummy bombs up again where they'd gone in the ground, and the kids used to love it, come and dig them out for us. And used to get these bombs, and if I remember right, they reckoned at this point at about 500 yards, a good crew could get about 15 bombs in the air before the first one landed. And by the time the last one landed, they were packed up and in the carriers and on the move away. Amazing, the efficiency of these mortars, which made me understand the situation better when we got to Normandy. And air infantry bodies, as I've probably said, there was always a love-hate relationship between infantry and tanks. If they needed you, they loved you. And when they didn't need you, if you were hanging about anywhere near them, they used to hate you. Because it always used to bring in these mortar bombs. As soon as the Germans heard tank movements, they would get the old mortars going. And you'd have a shower of them come over, boom, 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 you know. And poor old infantry lads, you know, they must have had casualties. Not killed properly, but wounded, must have had wounded. Simply because tanks were moving about close by them, you see. And having done this course, when I got to Normandy, I could appreciate more the danger to air infantry lads of these mortars. How powerful they were, you know. But I did this course, it was really interesting. How to carry a mortar, and the base plate, you know, when they, you know, they sort of say, well, you know, you fit you into a team, as they call them, you see, and they say, the officers say, well, you take one of the base plates, Corporal. I say, righto, sir, and you pick it, and you think, well, and you've got this lump of iron, which is the base plate, what you're going to slam, and it's all done to a drill, like everything is in the forces, of course, and you have to pick it up and clutch it, press it to your chest, otherwise you can't run fast, you see. If it's loose, if you're trying to carry it, you're off balance, so you pull it onto your chest hard, and you can run like buggery then, like you see. And when you get to where it's put his mark down, you get it, you slam it down, it weighs 20 pounds, the base plates did, and you slam it down, and all the teeth underneath go into the ground and get a grip, you see. And as soon as that's in, you jump out of the way, and up comes the bloke with the barrel, puts it in, because it's got a ball and socket joint, you see, at the bottom, like your shoulder, slams that in the plate, you see. And the other bloke comes up, he's got the tripod down, you see, and they clamp it in, they put the levelers on, the things with the bubble in, like, you know, put those on and wind them up, and they get a row of them, mate, in minutes. It's amazing, the speed, you know, and the officer would be there getting them all lined up and where they were, and then the fire a shot at the marker, and they give the fire orders out, get them all, and they come down, these bombs used to come down. God, they were devastating. But I did a course on that, and then I still didn't know what to do with it, so they sent me on a cadre course. I went to Infall Barracks in York, and there was an RSN there, he's a nice old boy, he was, and they're supposed to do a lot of cadre courses, learning to be a drill sergeant, or, you know, to donate to drill, shout commands and all that, you see. And I wasn't very good at shouting, but anyway, we survived. And it used to be comical, because they used to do this communication drill. And what it was, you'd have two rows of men spaced out, facing each other, and you had to shout commands to the one facing you, and the man on either side of him, who you were shouting to, would be shouting commands to the man either side of you, who you were shouting commands from, you see. And it used to be comical, like the voices used to intermingle. And it was, the idea was to learn you to choose the voice that was talking to you in amongst all the others. I don't know what the purpose of it was, other than the fact that if there was a lot of noise going on and somebody shouted, you knew who it was. Like, you knew it was Tom Jones, or, you know, it was Charlie Richards by the sound of his voice. You got to know each other's voices, you see. And it used to be comical, the chaos that used to reign coming from this communication drill. But we had one day, which was very interesting, and it poured a rain. It was never going to stop, you know. And this old RSM, he was treating it as a sort of a casual thing. It wasn't serious. And he said, right, he said, well, breakfast time, you see. And he came in the dining hall, he said, right, lads, he said, because he got about 30 of us, all corporals we were, from all different regiments. He said, right, lads, he said, say 9 o'clock in the gym. Righto, sir. So at 9 o'clock, we're all assembled in the gym, you see, and expecting to do PT. So we get there, you see, we've got all our gear on. Right, he said, get them forms and get around here, so he got some tables out, we've got them in. So he said, no, he said, let's have a bit of fun, shall we? And he said, get me a watch, Eddie. So he got his pocket watch out, put it on the timer in front of him. He said, no. He looked round, and there was a mug with no handle on. So he said to one of them, I said, give us that mug over. So he got it, gave it to him. He said, right. He said, no. When I say go, there's the mug. He gave it to one of these corporals. He said, 2 minutes, sensible talk on what you can do with that mug. And for 2 minutes, you had to talk sensibly and normal speed, not slack, about what you could do with that mug. How you could, when it's full in the winter, you could hold it with two hands to warm your hands because it ain't got a handle. And that's the wife. Yes. So this regimental sergeant major, he got this game, as it were, really, because the weather was bad and we couldn't do any training. So he said, right, he said, I'll put my watch down. He said, now, you take this mug, you got no handle on it. He said, now, 2 minutes, sensible talk, no hesitation, and go. He said, so for 2 minutes, this chap had got this mug and he was saying things like, if it's cold, he said, you can get it full of that, you know, that tea or whatever. He said, put your hands around, warm your hands. He said, keep your hands warm, he said. And then, of course, he said, when you're going to have a shave, you can always go down to cook it, get some hot water, have a shave with it. Rambled on, but he had to talk for 2 minutes, you see. And it's amazing how difficult it is to talk about something that you're not prepared to talk about for 2 minutes. It's surprising how long 2 minutes is. And I just give him a matchstick. He said, 2 minutes, give me a matchstick. And the chap had to talk about this matchstick. And, you know, it was really funny, like, you know, but it was amazing how intelligent it was, really, and something that really could probably be done in schools to create an interest among the students. You know, when they're getting a bit bored and right in the middle of a lesson, when you can sense they're all getting fed on board, say, right, let's have a bit of fun and do something like that for 2 minutes, you know. But it was comical, that was, and I enjoyed it when we did this cadre course. And then, of course, we were back, that was finished. It was only about a week, something like that. I still didn't know what to do with us, so they took over our squadron. We're given up Yorkshire, there's a place called Hunmanby, up near Whitby, and on the map is a place called Hunmanby Gap, and it's a cleft in the cliffs that allow you to go down onto the sands, you see. And at that point, although the beaches were all mined and barbed wired, the bottom of Hunmanby Gap was this area which had not been done, left clear for the locals and all that, you see. And it was an early thing, really, but there were these caravans and things like that, and little bungalows and holiday bungalows, and so we're all locked up for the duration, nobody there at all, you see. And anyway, some authority was used, I suppose, and now we're all opened up, and we had 4 days holiday, just lived there for 4 days using the facilities that each of these accommodations provided. Like, if you was in a bungalow, I mean, the cupboards would have all the utensils and things, and so you just used it, you see. But there was no bedding and stuff, so you had to take your blankets to use on the beds and that. And it was interesting because I happened to be guard commander, because we still had to have patrols and things, and I happened to be guard commander, and one of the lads came in. He said, hey, buddy, he says, I don't know what's going on. He says, a bloke down on the beach, he said, he's digging. So I said, digging? He said, yeah, he's got a bucket, and he's digging. So I said, oh, I better go and have a look. So I wandered down with him, you see, and we went down. This chap was there, got a spade and that. I said, excuse me. I said, what are you doing, like? Oh, he said, hello, Corporal. He said, I'm just putting my lines out. He said, tide's coming in. So I said, oh, what's that got to do with it then? And what he got was all these lines with hooks. And they're all baited with ragworm, you see, each hook separately. And he got a piece of iron at the end of each end of the line. And he buried that in the sand, you see. And the line laid along the top of the sand. And then these lugworm things were burying themselves in the sand. So I said, oh, I said, I'll go fishing. I said, I never do anything like this, you know. I said, it's interesting. I said, what happens then? Well, he said, the tide comes in. He said, but how to judge it right? He said, by the time I put these lines out, and before these lugworms can bury themselves, the seagull come down and pinch them. He said, I've got a line full of seagulls. He said, before the tide's covered it, you see. So the seagulls come down, hook themselves on his line. So he said, I have to get it right. So the tide covers them almost as laying them, you see. He said, then I had to come back when the tide's going out again, time it right. He said, that was the seagulls eat all my fish once on the line, you see, so he can get the fish off. I said, that's bloody cunning, isn't it, you know. And that's what he was doing. He's putting these lines out to catch the fish. And, you know, it was interesting to me, that was. And as I say, there was just this section left for the locals to go down and play about on the sand and that. And we'd had 4 days there, you know, just a holiday, a break. They didn't know what to do with us, you know. There's all this time and there's no training they could give us, but they'd still got to, I just couldn't sort of let you loose. And they couldn't send you on leave, you know, because they needed you there, because they didn't know, from the organisation point of view, I suppose, when the marching orders came, when the movement orders came. They wouldn't know that, you see, until somebody told them. Well, that went on, and then of course we'd got to move south to go for Normandy, you see. And we went down to Fareham, and they got a big camp there, a barbed wire camp, like a prisoner of war camp really. And the weather was atrocious. It was raining, it was all mud and terrible it was, and it was in bell tents, you know, not very good. And of course we didn't go over to Normandy until D10. We were supposed to go on D5, but the weather and everything else apparently put everything back. I'm rather jumping the gun here. We went down from Yorkshire to Aldershot before we went to Fareham, and there we received our final Cromwells, which we had to seal up for whaling, because they didn't know whether we should land wet or dry. And although we didn't expect to do any fighting, because, as I say, we were not expected to land till D5. And when we got down to Aldershot, we got these Cromwells, and we were spending, thrashing about, sealing them up for a 13 feet wading, with the big funnels on the back over the exhaust and all sorts of things. And I didn't think at the time, you know, you don't think about these things initially, but it's more after the war when you read books or you think about things and you reminisce in your mind, that the poor old driver, the only bloke who was going to get out was the commander, because the whole vehicle was sealed. And finally, when we got down to Wareham, the doors, the drivers and the co-driver, they were all sealed after they were in, finally, you see. And so when we actually landed, the vehicle was a solid block except for the commander. He was the only one with his head out. And it was a rather funny experience, that, being a commander in a sealed up tank, because the only air that came in through his turret. And what he'd got on the top to level you off was a box, metal box, which was sealed down to the roof of the turret, not welded on because it got to be removed, but sealed down with Bostik and tape and all that sort of stuff. And it was about, I suppose, about 2 feet, 18 inches to 2 feet tall. And that was the only way to get in to the turret, the gunner and the turret man, the wireless operator. And then of course the driver and the co-driver got in and were finally sealed prior to your landing, you see. And at the back was this big oblong thing, like a big chest, which went across the back of the tank, and that was where all the exhaust and that came out, you see. But all the air came in through the commander's thing. And when you got in there, if I hadn't had my elbows over the top, I'm sure I'd have got sucked in with the draft. It was pulling as though someone was got out your ankles, dragging you down, it was. And anyway, when we were down at Aldershot, it seemed to me that there wasn't enough emphasis in discipline to make you do things that I've thought about afterwards that you should have been made to do. And we had an officer, and in the gymnasium he'd got a big sand table set out and a big map all across the wall of Normandy. And after the landing had took place, or we were still at Aldershot on D-Day, and in Haglines at Paris, and he got these maps, and he got a radio contact, because he would go off, and then about every hour, 2 hours, he would come in and alter the maps where formations had changed positions. And he'd got this sand table set out on the floor, and he got his long pointer, and he was making movements on that to indicate where there'd been forward movements or backward movements of forces on the beach. And of course he was only doing the beachhead that we were going to land on. He wasn't doing the whole five landing beaches. It was just Air Beach, which was Juno, and we landed at Corsair, as you see. So he was only doing the area that he felt we would be involved in, which we would be familiar with, you see. I mean, we didn't know what anybody else was doing, but it was expected that we would have some idea of what we would be doing. In fact, when we landed, we did nothing. But there was no, in my opinion, they should have got all the tank commanders and arranged for them all to be there at that time. It was just left to the individual to show his own interest to go in and watch it and look at it and ask questions and talk to him. You know, this should have been compulsory, I think, for all the tank commanders to have attended at least once a day to be put in a picture of what had happened, what was happening, what might happen, you know, and all that sort of thing. And I was very interested, and I know a friend of mine, a particular friend, he's very interested. He's always talking to me about my experiences. And the fact that I survived, Ken Tate, who's wrote four books at the moment, he's on two more at the moment, he's always been interested in me, because he said, you're one of the few tank commanders who remained a troop corporal and fought in all the three major battles that the regiment was in, which was Epsom, Goodwood and Bluecoat, and survived every one in your capacity as a troop corporal tank commander, which is very unusual, you know, generally, to have someone to go right through the whole lot, you see, from beginning to end. And so he always like refers me to people, refers people to me, you see. But anyway, I used to go in on my own account because I was interested and wanted to know and all that. And I think the fact that I did these sort of things probably indirectly helped me to survive, which I did, although I was wounded twice, once in Normandy with the Yeomanry and once with the 1st Royal Tank Regiment but in Holland. But, you know, little things, and it was interesting to know. And he told me something. I mean, there may have been other people there at the time, may not have been the only one, but I don't recollect it being a collectively organised attendance, put it that way. And I used to go voluntarily, and I used to talk to him a lot. And he was telling me, as I say, probably a group of us, I don't remember a group being there, I speak as an individual. He said, now, one thing you've got to understand, and by now, you see, we were there when D-Day happened, and we moved down to Fareham several days after D-Day, because things were not going as well as expected, and consequently, the facilities down at Fareham were still, I suppose, occupied by troops which should have already gone for us to go down. So instead of us going, landing on D5 and probably being down Fareham by D3, we didn't get down to Fareham till about D6, you see. So all this time we're watching the war go on and reading about it and hearing about it. And I'm talking to this chap, you see, and by now, to him as an intelligence officer, there was a picture forming of what was happening on the beach, of the progress or lack of progress of the forces landing. And I always remember him saying, now when you get there, don't get worried or despondent or downcast and think things are going wrong. because when you get there as a tank commander, you can be prepared to operate in an area as small as the playing area at Aldershot Barracks for several days at a time, because he said the fighting is so confined, forward movement is so slow, that if they're not careful, the troops at the back are going to get despondent and think things are gone wrong. They're not gone wrong, he said. There's had to be a formulation of a deliberate approach.